Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dave Tomlin with Iowa Healthcare Association. Welcome to today's webinar, Addressing Stress and Anxiety Resulting from the COVID-19 Pandemic. All phones and will be muted, so you won't be able to talk during the webinar. If you do have a question, we're going to hold the questions till the end. Questions can be typed in the chat box and submitted for the speaker to address. So now let me introduce our speaker today. Barbara Speedling is the Quality of Life Specialist for Innovations for Quality Living. Barbara provides staff education and program development designed to satisfy a broad range of special needs for seniors. Barbara began her career in long-term care and recreational therapy, later specializing in the development of environments and programs for people with dementia and mental illness. Go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you, Dave, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm so happy to be able to bring this session to you. I've been talking to people around the country about the impact of COVID and all of the restrictions and directives that we've been given in long-term care and, you know, what it's doing to people on a psychosocial level. And, you know, throughout this conversation, we'll be talking about not just your residents, but about yourselves and your colleagues and the families that, you know, are the extended customers of your service. So as I'm talking to people, I'm finding that there is a broad range of emotion and circumstances that people are facing. I'm here in New York City, which obviously was the epicenter of the pandemic a couple of months ago. And now, thankfully, we're moving in another direction, but it remains to be seen if we can, you know, maintain that status. And certainly around the country, we're seeing that you know, we haven't really gotten people to understand the nature of this illness. And so I think that we're going to be looking at the outcomes, the cabin fever, if you will, and other things that are going to result from this in the next couple of months. And being able to anticipate some of those things and know how you're going to address certain issues before they occur or as they're, you know, occurring in your environment can help your staff, I think, and your residents feel as though there is still a sense of structure and control. You know, we're talking a lot in these conversations, too, about how much this pandemic is changing the culture of long-term care. You know, we've always aspired to be these home-like, residential, person-centered environments, and now I have some people reporting that residents are saying it's more like a prison than it's ever been, and especially in places where we have to stay with our doors closed and, you know, we're so isolated from others. So I think there's a lot to talk about, and in putting together this series of discussions for you over the next three, you know, sessions, we'll talk a lot about the various aspects of not only the emotion itself, but ways to look at remedies. You know, I'll give you a simple example. One of the things I've been doing here for an organization that has a number of facilities is talking with frontline staff, either in small groups of two or three people or on an individual basis, just a casual chat about their emotions and the things that they're feeling. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that they don't understand some of the things that they're feeling. They don't always attribute it to what's going on, COVID, you know, directly, that there's an indirect kind of association with the, you know, the emerging feelings that they're having. And a lot of people are saying that the environment is changing so much that it isn't even pleasant or you know, something they look forward to go to work as they once did. So as we talk about these things, I want you to keep in mind that this is a very human issue, and beyond issues of grief or traumatic stress, which, you know, is a part of all of this, there are some very simple feelings that we have that, you know, as I explore them with people, the things that we, you know, don't attribute to what's happening in the pandemic, things like sleeplessness or changes in appetite or energy or things like that. You know, these are ways to anticipate some of that, maybe identify for people some of the things that we're feeling. And one of the more important things out of this conversation for us as caregivers is making sure that we don't overlook escalations or exacerbations of behavior and mood as just being who you are or what you always do. You know, we've been talking over the last 2 years now or so about trauma-informed care and recognizing what post-traumatic, you know, issues are, and now is the time to apply that information. You know, now is the time to put that thinking into play and to really, you know, respond to the obligation to have staff that are culturally competent and, you know, able with the skill sets to care for the people in the current circumstances that we have. So I think it's going to challenge us on a lot of levels psychosocially that we haven't really considered before. And the fact that it impacts everyone, not just the resident population, but even the caregiving population and beyond, is a situation we haven't faced perhaps since we started to care for people with HIV. And even then, it wasn't as, you know, intense and as pervasive as it is today. So just beginning to look at how this all began and the things that, you know, have motivated residents' feelings and some of the things that we should be anticipating, just understanding, you know, what grief is and what limitations have been put on us that are going to cause us, you know, to grieve some of those freedoms and, you know, expressions of socialness and so on that we've been accustomed to. So in the early parts of March, when a lot of this got started and we really started to see the infections begin to escalate, there were a lot of directives now about social distancing and, you know, making sure that we were aware of infection control and making sure that we were, you know, putting into place systems and processes that were going to help to control the spread of the disease and avoid what we are seeing now, which is a very serious public health risk and, you know, that keeps growing and really doesn't show us, at least in our industry, an end in sight for how long we're going to have to deal with these restrictions and so on. As places have opened up, we've seen that some have had to, you know, step back now and reconsider what they're doing. So this situation, you know, has intensified in a lot of ways. And so looking at the travel restrictions even now, more than 20 states, people coming into our state here in New York from other areas. So as well as we've been, what if people aren't reporting and what if they're not, you know, really being accurate or reporting or staying put and quarantining when they get here? So a lot of these things cause many different feelings in people. There's fear, there's, you know, hesitation, there's hostility. People are angry. You know, when we talk about the stages of grief and we see the anger and the, you know, the hostility toward others and in some cases, even the denial, you know, that is so vicious in some people where they're so angry and they think this is a hoax. And I invite them all the time. I say, well, you know, come in and shadow me in my work or in the industry that I'm in and you'll see perhaps that this is quite serious. So the things that we are really looking at now, the distancing, the no visitation, some families, you know, that might have been questioning some of your care or maybe those families that were there every day and felt like they were a part of the fabric of the home. What are their emotions now? Do you have people who are impatient with these limitations? Are you dealing with anger and frustration or suspicion? You know, here I've had a couple of clients be challenged by families who are saying, well, you know, why can't I see my mother? And, you know, let me see a copy of that memo. I don't believe that. I haven't heard that. So you're going to see a broad range of things all coming from these very basic directives that we had to limit our contact with other people. So as we look at the way people are dealing with all of this stress, I think that's where we see a diversity of reactions and circumstances. So let's talk first about the staff. In those conversations that I've been having with people, some of the things that have been coming out are conflicts between coworkers who traditionally kind of rub each other the wrong way, but now these things have really intensified, and certainly there's kind of a brittle atmosphere that you know, that everybody feels. You know, certainly when you walk in on people who are arguing, as soon as you walk into the room, they stop their conversation, but you can feel the energy. You can feel that the ambiance is disrupted by that negative, you know, conversation they're having. And you know, just by experience, that you should get whatever you came for very quickly because they're going to go right back to having that argument when you leave. So what does the atmosphere feel like? And that's the first place I want to start in talking about this cultural impact. So, you know, nursing homes, typically we are trying to be lighthearted for our residents all the time and doing fun things and parties and all of that. Well, all of that's gone now. So how are you controlling that ambiance? How are you shifting the culture? So let's take, for instance, controlling perhaps sleep ambiance and the hygiene of sleep. And so many people are not being able to sleep well now. They're worried. They're feeling disjointed. Schedules are off. We don't have a structure. So maybe you could do things like make a concerted effort as the evening goes on to lower the volume in the environment. Many nursing facilities, even assisted livings, are loud. You know, we don't realize the you know, extraneous noise that's impacting people. So having a conscious, you know, way of calming the environment down, maybe having some aromatherapy, some lavender scent, you know, infused into the environment, a natural calming, you know, effort. Maybe even playing over the overhead speaker for, you know, a period of time later in the evening. Some music that really is intended to help people calm down. Something that always comes to mind for me is Chopin's Nocturne Number 9, that many people recommend as a melody that helps people to sort of, you know, unwind, relax, and so on. So that's just one small way of anticipating what the stress may do to the people in the environment. So another avenue to travel, perhaps, in coping and dealing with some of the stress that we might feel. Years ago, when I worked in a facility in Brooklyn, they had a stress-reducing activity every morning at 10 a.m. Somebody would announce, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's 10 a.m. It's time to stretch." And everyone, you know, staff, visitors, residents, everybody would stop what they were doing for 60 seconds and just stretch. And the point of it was that when the 60 seconds were over, you felt like a fresh start to that morning. And so it had an effect on people, a positive effect. People might forget what they were, you know, engaged in for that moment and able to, you know, start over and start fresh. So maybe we need something like the 2 p.m. shout out, you know, something at the end of the shift, or some way to expend that nervous energy that comes with anxiety and, you know, trying to cope with the day-to-day trauma of what's going on around me. I had a housekeeper explained to me just recently that the trauma for him was seeing so many residents that he had gotten to know so well over the years, one by one, leave the facility in rapid succession. And he said, you know, each time another person would go and you'd feel this overwhelming sense of you know, sadness and hopelessness about what you might be able to do, or if this person even is able going to come back, you know, to the facility. So I think that not even overlooking anybody in the environment and what they might be feeling, and anticipating that those feelings are there, even if we don't talk about it, or maybe we're going to express it in some way that doesn't really look like what you thought it was. So maybe I'm very short-tempered and I'm you know, snapping at people. And maybe that's another sign of my feeling of depression. You know, we often say that depression is rage, you know, internalized. So think about the ways that people might be expressing, and know that everybody responds to stress and expresses themselves differently. So certainly we know that people who are more compromised, like children, adults with, you know, chronic illness, or, you know, compromised to their independence, may be feeling more stress. You know, the person who can't get out of bed without help may be worried that there's not going to be enough people to help them. So, you know, everyone reacts differently. So be prepared. You should be talking about this with your staff, with your leadership team, you know, triage the people in the environment and the things that you might see going on around you, and be able to talk about it before it escalates and spirals out of control. So like we said, we know that some people are going to respond more intensely than others. But looking at this point right here, where we talk about those of us at the front line, I was just talking with someone earlier, a nun that I work with through one of the local parishes, and we do a monthly wellness program for the community where we talk about all kinds of things, you know, caring for ourselves, caring for others, navigating long-term care, you know, lots of things that we do as a free education forum for the people in the community. And I was talking to her about a terminology I had just become familiar with, talking about moral injury. and tying that into COVID and those people at the front line, first responders, who might be, you know, having to make decisions that go against their own moral thinking. When we were talking about advanced directives early on, people with do not resuscitate orders, or even in some circles, there was a, you know, an encouragement to look at people of advanced age, and if they didn't have a DNR, you know, encourage them to have one now. So, you know, there are a lot of things that might impact those people that are working and decisions that they might have to make or be involved in. So there's a lot to this moral injury thinking and how it impacts the way people also behave behind their own stress. So people with mental health conditions, certainly those who are substance or alcohol seeking, those are people to be particularly aware of. If you have an environment where you have residents with abuse issues, with, you know, tendencies for alcohol, seeking behavior. And if you don't drug test your staff, you may want to be aware of what, you know, indulgence looks like, in the workforce as well, because people are having difficulty now just dealing with all of the tension and the stress and the, forgive me for using a less than academic term, but the weirdness of everything that's going on around us. Many people feel very disjointed. I know even for myself that my circadian rhythm is all off. My sleeping schedule is off. So people are going to show these things, and some people are going to go seeking remedies that might not be so good for them. So some of the things that we might be stressed about during this kind of an outbreak, I'm going to say right off the top, without even looking at my list here, that one of the biggest things I find stressful, and I'm speaking now individually, but I think some of you may share those feelings, I think that the inconsistency of the information and the directives that we're receiving from the different, you know, federal and state and local entities, that's what's distressing to me, is that, you know, we don't have a clear pathway here or a consistent way or a shared, you know, plan amongst the states, amongst the cities and so on to, get through this. So I find myself being concerned, being insecure about the information. And I think if your residents feel that way, if they're watching, you know, the television constantly and they're hearing this ongoing story about what we don't have and how many people are dying and are going to die and the doom and gloom that we're listening to, you know, 24/7, I think that you're going to see even more stressful reactions. So again, how are you controlling the culture? Through your therapeutic activities. And if you have a closed channel through your cable provider, you know, change what we're watching, show something more interesting, you know, have a schedule of programs since we can't gather that I can see in my room on my, you know, on my television. So again, you know, perhaps minimizing the amount of stress that might result from the things that I'm listening to constantly. If we can take away some of those triggers, obviously everything might, you know, get better in your environment. Other things, like we said, talking about sleeping, obviously those things are going to be impacting people. But even more so, social dining is another void that we've had to suffer now through all of this. And I would tell you that in all the years I've been doing this, one of the most significant things that people look forward to in long-term care is dining. And even people who don't come to activities or don't want a roommate, or they still like to come out a lot of times and mingle, observe, listen in on what's going on, even if they don't want to be a part of it. You know, so without that socialness of the dining environment, we're really missing something here. You know, and then consider how much telemedicine, you know, robotic responses, like I was talking yesterday to a group about, you know, robots that we're using now, robotic nurses and so on. So we're already, you know, shying away from human contact as a result of our infection control issues. But even more now, socially, we're eating by ourselves, we're sitting by ourselves all the time, you know, and even if we do get together, we're not really even close enough. For a lot of these folks with hearing deficits or vision, you know, problems, other kinds of things, dementia, to really be able to socialize across the social distancing, you know, measures and so on. So some of the things I've been talking to local clients about as we, you know, brainstorm about the ways that they could do things, many times, you know, we might be able to go to the doorway of someone who's eating in their room and perhaps staying at a distance, you know, be able to talk with them while they eat or enjoy my cup of coffee while they have their lunch, you know, trying to bring some socialization back into what, you know, used to be a very pleasant, perhaps, meal experience. The other thing I'm seeing through some of the quality assurance work that I do with clients is a lot of significant weight loss. And I think that you need to jump on that and pay attention now to things like intermittent snacks, even, you know, sending up and delighting people with things they weren't expecting, you know, something, you know, for a special dessert, and provide it for the staff too. Make it something everybody gets. So it's more like an event, more like a special diversion, you know, that you might offer. Something that's going to help also counter that stress is to have a pleasant, you know, distraction from all of it. So if you can couple that with helping people to eat better and have a better intake during the day, then, you know, by all means, do that. Sleeping, we talked about. Concentrating. You know, again, people who are not really involved, who aren't structured, who have cognitive deficits, are not really able to, you know, structure their own time. And sometimes when I see care plans for someone in a moderate to a late stage dementia that says they plan their own day, I really think they do. You know, how can they do that? So I think there has to be some structure in place for the people that, you know, are having difficulty focusing, those who can't read books or work on their computers or talk on their smartphones or, you know, those kinds of folks. What are we doing to help them to have a better structure? And if that is just a matter of putting together a couple of individualized diversionary activities like memory boxes or, you know, puzzles or things of that nature, then that would be a worthy thing to do to help, you know, overcome some of the stress that goes with having to constantly, you know, try to redirect someone. So finding a way to help those people with short attention to get a better way of, you know, engaging and staying focused, concentrating would be another thing. And quiet, obviously we have a lot of that now, is going to help you along there. I also think we're going to see more neediness amongst those people that, you know, are prone to what we call attention getting behavior, or perhaps just being very needy of, you know, support in whatever chronic issues they're facing. And certainly we know that people are just in general worried about their health and the health and safety of their loved ones. And in your facilities, it's going to extend to residents being concerned about the staff that they're close to, and vice versa, just like the housekeeper was explaining to me. So again, I think that information, putting out accurate information, timely, and making sure that you do it on a regular basis so people feel as though they don't have to go searching for information, and that you're transparent. You know, you're doing the best you can, and that you admit when in fact you are struggling. I think it's better that people know that you are doing your best and that you're, you know, you're weathering these challenges the best way that you know how, and keeping them abreast of everything that's going on is going to really build that confidence and hopefully overcome some of those feelings that may, you know, follow months of extended restrictions that we're looking at. You know, someone spoke to me yesterday and said that we may see this for another, you know, 12 to 18 months. Consider how much, you know, fatigue after even just a few more months of what we're facing now. Other kinds of things, like we said, too, looking at, you know, just other reliance, increased use of, you know, tobacco products, people smoking more. This, for instance, would not be the time to encourage someone to, you know, pursue smoking cessation. And you may even find people who, you know, had successfully quit smoking, for instance, and now, of course, they want to pick it back up again. So, you know, be prepared. Have some support conversations, some research or resource, you know, opportunities for people to learn about what stress does to them. Maybe even printing and putting out for people just informational fact sheets on COVID and the coping things. The CDC has a lot of resources. I have some, you know, I'll give you my contact information at the end if you'd like any of the things that I've collected and, you know, distributed here amongst my local client facilities. I'm happy to share those things, but I think we need to really have things in place, services, resources, education, so that you can be proactive. You know, we're pretty much reactive in long-term care. A lot of times we wait until something happens to us before we really think about it. And the other thing I would encourage you to do is think about how much you've already done in preparing for emergency and disasters. You know, a lot of the things that you need now to address the trauma and the stress of the pandemic, you've already started in your disaster policies. So, you know, don't reinvent everything. Don't put added stress on your staff, your leadership team, in having to reinvent all these policies. Go and look at what you have and add to them. Make addendums, you know. And one of the things you want to do, I think, also to make sure that we're all on the same page, which helps to reduce, you know, our anxiety over issues like this, is keep a chronological recording of your policies and as you morph them along with new directives and changes in policies that come from the, you know, the governmental agencies, keep them in a chronological file so that when you're asked to show your, you know, your succession of enhancements and revisions, something that was happening here through the infection control surveys, they were wanting to see a succession of infection control policy that kept pace with each of the various directives for testing and so on that came out. So that's another way to reduce the stress amongst your staff, is to be proactive, to be a step ahead. So think, you know, reasonably about organization. And if you don't already have a quality assurance subcommittee focused on the psychosocial issues, the COVID impact on the environment, on the people in the environment, you need to have one where somebody on that subcommittee pays attention to these constant, you know, daily memos and updates. Another person is checking policy. Another is preparing staff education and resident and family notices. So, you know, if you use your quality assurance process effectively, none of these kinds of things are going to stress your team so drastically. You know, that's what you have quality assurance for, is to put a framework in place to meet whatever circumstances come up and to be able to check that system on an ongoing basis to make sure that, you know, everything is working, that you're compliant, and that, you know, you've done your best to keep everything moving forward and sustain those efforts. So now we know that we care for this very vulnerable population and by extension, their families as well. So rather than avoiding, as some of my local clients have done to their own detriment, rather than avoiding family involvement and, you know, trying to keep families at bay, better to embrace the families, the other support networks in your community, and looking forward to more proactive kinds of things. So, you know, helping to reach out in the community to find, you know, services that we might need. So say, for instance, when we were talking about trauma-informed care and the new behavioral health regulations, I encouraged a lot of facilities to establish relationships now with addiction counseling services so that one day, certainly not even talking about a pandemic at that point, but just certainly at some point if your demographics should shift and you have a population like this, you'd already have those resources in place. So that's what I would encourage you to do now, is look at all of the support networks, all of the people that are out there to be able to help you to be proactive. Now is the time to, you know, make sure that we're all on the same page. And as we're talking here, to really pay attention to best practice and to the experts that, you know, are really helping us to weather all of these changes. So now, as you're looking at the residents in your building, let's shift now to that focus, talking about prioritizing. Certainly, you're not going to be able to meet the needs of everybody all at once. You're not going to be able to triage the behavioral health issues for everyone all at once. So give yourself an opportunity to put people into a hierarchy. Certainly, first and foremost, those people who can occupy themselves, who can say to you, oh, you know, gosh, I'm okay. I can, you know, talk to people. I have my computer. You know, those people who seem to be, you know, working through their adjustment. Those are the folks I think that you can come back to a little later. But residents that already have a diagnosis of depression, I would pay special attention to the behavior and mood of people that we know are already diagnosed with a depressive disorder, especially a long-standing disorder, maybe that's coupled with other things like anxiety or post-traumatic stress. Sometimes dementia and depression can, you know, cause an escalation in mood and behavior. But I think it's very important that you begin to look at those most vulnerable people first. So even people with a diagnosis of trauma, not necessarily post-traumatic stress, but I've seen people with a diagnosis of trauma that's related to traumatic pain. I've seen other people with a trauma slash anxiety diagnosis based on the fall that they had that landed them, you know, in the long-term care facility. So I think your team needs to really look at the population from that perspective. Who really is the most vulnerable now because of their diagnosis and circumstance? And who can, you know, who can I wait a little bit longer to focus on, you know, putting them to in a hierarchy that way? Excuse me. So people with dementia, with brain injury, we know that there are certain behavior and symptomatic kinds of things that we have to address proactively. So, excuse me. So, for instance, in dementia, you may have people who are prone to motor agitation, who need to move about. If they're ambulatory, they're going to want to wander. If they are not ambulatory, they might have banging behavior or picking behavior or calling out. So you're not going to, you know, quell those behaviors so easily, and they're not just going to go away because you, you know, you wanted them to stop moving. These people have to move. They have to indulge that psychomotor agitation. So if I am someone who's an ambulatory wanderer, you're not going to keep me in my room. It's going to be very difficult. So maybe you want to work with your therapeutic activity and your rehab departments and set up a free wandering space that is both compliant in terms of social distancing and infection control, but will also satisfy the need of that person to move. You are not going to get them to stay still, and that's something you need to think about. Because if you try to control that movement in a way that, you know, is disruptive, you try to make me sit down, or I just had somebody tell me today that they got in trouble on a survey because they had put the man's T-shirt, they had pulled it down over the back of a stationary chair. In other words, he couldn't get up now because his shirt was over the chair. So we know that's a restraint, but they were at a loss apparently as to how to keep him from getting up from his chair unattended. Please don't do, you know, things like that or allow people to think that that's something we can do. But what are you going to do in the interim? If I'm a person who bangs or picks, maybe you want to make a big Ziploc bag, like if you go to the store that sells for like clothing, you know, they have big Ziploc bags, fill them with colorful craft sand, a bright color, seal them with crazy glue, and give that to the person and make sure it's assigned so there's no infection control problems. That's their pat mat. You know, commercial pat mats that you fill with water usually end up being more trouble than they're worth. They're cheap, they break. But if you make your own, that may be a way to satisfy and, you know, quiet some of that agitation and give somebody the opportunity to, you know, use it in a productive sort of way. People with mental disorders, I think, are going to take a little bit more explanation, more conversation. Looking at people with schizophrenia, people with bipolar depression, prone to mania, or people with paranoia, you know, those are the people that you're going to have to really talk to. I've said kind of tongue in cheek throughout these COVID discussions, you know, and talking about telemental health and so on, that, you know, for years we've been telling the person with a schizophrenic and paranoid diagnosis not to listen to the man in the television, and now all of a sudden we have to listen. So, you know, there's going to have to be some real conversation behind that and satisfying people's curiosity about how it works and knowing that it might not work for everybody. It might not be a forum that works, you know. So thinking about what you're going to do as an alternative if the remedies that we've put in place for everyone don't work for every individual. So be thinking about how you talk to people, making sure that for residents who might be hesitant to believe you, that you have printed information to share, that you can send them to the CDC websites to validate the things that you're saying. I had a man in one building saying that he didn't believe that he had to wear a mask, you know, that he was being singled out. So we had to make sure that he understood that this is a directive that is being, you know, encouraged for everyone. It wasn't just him. So again, prioritizing people, anticipating extreme emotion. You know, people are going to assimilate only for so long. Then some people are going to terribly withdraw. Others are perhaps going to demonstrate an escalation in their mania. Oh, I can't stay in the room. I have to get out. I have to get out. You know, I've heard some of those stories already. Getting tired of the PPE. We even have staff who are cutting corners to their own detriment, you know, not wanting to put on, especially as it gets hotter now in the summer months. They don't want to put everything on. So we should expect this. This is not an easy time for anybody. And if you're feeling any of this yourself, you have to expect that the people around you are feeling it. The families at home, the people who used to come every day and stay for hours with mother or wife or whoever and eat lunch and do all of that. How are they feeling now? And are they getting impatient with all of this? And are they becoming less patient with us because they're not a part of the daily fabric anymore? They feel, you know, disconnected. So what are we doing? In some places, you know, they've had group family meetings through Zoom like this, where we can still see that there are other families. It's not just us. And it can be a positive conversation if you can direct it that way, you know. But there's a lot of ways to reach out to people and to, you know, really give them a forum for talking about all of these things that are happening. So now, what have you done to anticipate, you know, the remedies for people in your environment? Where can residents and staff express themselves safely? You know, is there a way for me to say, you know, I've just had it up to here? Like, when do you want to say that's the last straw, you know, and to make sure that we don't dump that in the wrong place, where can we dump it appropriately? You know, I always tell the story about a Radio Shack store that I was never able to go back in again because I dumped it there one day when I was mad at somebody else. You know, thankfully they're not there anymore. But, you know, we all do that as human beings. We take that emotion with us. So this is where you have to really say, well, if I don't want it to come out during care, you know, if I don't want that frustrated staff member to transfer somebody by themselves when the person is a, you know, a two-person transfer and now we're going to have an incident, you know, then I have to be prepared. I have to recognize that they need a moment or that they need a place to take that frustration. As a manager, I used to tell my staff, if you're having a bad day, come down here to the office. You can shut the door. You can yell. You can throw things. You can have a tantrum. Do whatever you want. But if you do it anywhere but here, it's going to be a problem. So because they knew that there was a place that they could go as a haven for those emotions of frustration or feeling overwhelmed or you're having a bad day, a lot of times they didn't even need to use it, but they knew there was a place. So just like that, what could you do for your staff? You know, what do they need? Where can they get away for a moment? Where can your residents be alone? You know, some of the facilities here in New York still have 3- and 4-bedded rooms that have been waivered in. So if I don't want to be with 3 other people in my misery, where can I go to be by myself for a little while? Just a little meditative, you know, time away. Is there a place? And can you maintain it safely so that other people could, you know, use it as well? So this is really taking what we know about the pandemic and about all the restrictions and infection control necessities and so on, but still making it work for us. And isn't that what we should do with our knowledge, is bleed it into our policies and procedures and the way that we do things. So again, not dismissing the behavior as just normal or, oh, just what they always do, and making sure again that we empower people with good information, making sure that we're timely, that we're accurate, that we're transparent. Those are going to be the things that are going to help these emotions go the other way, keep people more comfortable. You know, as we walk through the various stages of grief, you know, we go through the denial and we go through the anger and the bargaining. And then we finally get into a place where we can say, well, you know, I can't really do anything about it, so I'm going to make it work for me. And I think that once we can reach that, you know, a lot of this extreme emotion is going to have an outlet that's going to satisfy and it won't, you know, escalate into something else. So be aware of these emotions. Make sure that you talk about abuse with your staff. You know, I can remember years ago, as a consultant working on a plan of correction, where a nursing assistant trying to get a gentleman with dementia to sit down in the dining room in the chair for lunch, he wouldn't sit. He had aphasia. He didn't understand. And she didn't have good training. So she asked him several times to sit. He didn't get it. So finally, she put her hands on his shoulders and tried to push him down into the chair. So he slapped her, and then she slapped him back. And that was a knee-jerk reflex kind of thing. And she even said, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't mean to do that, but you did it. You did it because you were frustrated and there was no other way to let that out. So talk about this with people. You know, be alert to disagreements, to grievances, to the way people are talking. You know, one resident grievance that I read not too long ago when I was on site was about how on a particular day, the resident didn't like the way the staff member spoke to her. That morning, she said to her, come on, lazy bones, it's time to get up. We find out in the investigation, and the resident admits that the staff member has called her lazy bones many times before, and it was never a problem, but today it was a problem. And I think that's where you have to really look, is what is this stress doing to us, and are things that might have been benign before going to escalate or become a bigger problem? So be quick to resolve grievances, step in, don't let people fight their own battles, you know, have a way of mediating what's going on, residents and staff and families if need be. And then again, be open and honest with people. Let them know that, you know, this is stressful, you understand that, and if they need to express themselves, you're there. It's an open door, people can talk, but not letting those things happen, you know, that are going to have these things escalate and really become, you know, a more significant problem for us. So there's a lot of things that we could do to expend the energy, to divert the attention away from the stressful things that are going on. Certainly we know that physical activity causes more production of those endorphins, those, you know, chemicals in our body that make us feel better. So what are you doing to increase the physical activity? You know, I always talk about the fact that residents, for the most part, if they're not ambulatory, they do a lot of sitting, a lot of imploding throughout the day. You know, I say we feed them breakfast and then they sit. And then we give them a snack and they sit, and lunch and they sit. And so by dinner time, you know, they've got all this food in them and they haven't moved much. And so nothing's really working. Their bowels aren't working and their appetite is gone. So, you know, not just for those reasons, but also as an outlet for stress, what could we do? So be talking about, you know, things like I said, like the 2 o'clock shout out, or maybe once every hour, you know, throughout the hallway, we encourage people to march in place or to wave their arms or, you know, just do something. I saw one thing on the internet where staff had like a dancer-size competition down the hallway, you know, where residents joined in if they could or something like that. So be a little silly, you know, help people to stimulate those feelings of feeling better, being more proactive, you know, doing other kinds of things like real range of motion activities with people, either in, you know, small, you know, socially distanced groups or in hallways, sharing doorways with people and other kinds of things that are fun. But remember that, you know, once it's done, like say, you know, a hallway bingo, it's going to lose its luster after a while. So we've got to be thinking all the time about ways to be creative. And I think that that's another think tank activity for your team. Let's be thinking about how we can keep people, you know, on an up and up, how we can keep them thinking positively. Other things you want to do, be flexible. You know, schedules don't have to be written in stone. Assignments don't have to be written in stone. If I can't get along with resident, you know, 13 today because of the way that they push my buttons, well, then it should be okay for me and my coworker to make a swap and to let my supervisor know that we're doing that and why we're doing it so much better than forcing somebody to continue in a relationship that's not going to be healthy for them. So, you know, you don't want to promote those negative reactions in people. The other thing you want to do is, again, control the environment. You know, what's being put out there on social media is devastating in a lot of ways. So if you have a Facebook page or your facility is posting on Twitter, make sure that you're showcasing all the wonderful things that your staff is doing, that your residents are feeling, you know, thanking people and showcasing people. When I think now to all the brave souls that are working in long-term care and how much the news media overlooks all of that. You know, all you really ever hear out of the news media is that we kill people and we steal their money. And now, with the help of the government in some states, they're looking at healthcare workers as the big bad, you know, disease carriers, even though we didn't know anything more at the start of all of this than anyone else. How are we supposed to prevent the spread when we didn't know what the spread was all about? But you don't hear that. So self-promotion, making sure we recognize people, that we, you know, that we thank people for the work they're doing. It is a job that is thankless most of the time. And it is a job now that's even so much more complex than it was even 6 months ago. You know, a thankless job that's complex and stressful is not one that people are breaking the doors down to do. So we've got to make sure that we cultivate the staff that we have, that we nurture them, and that we value them, and the residents as well. So, you know, doing the things that you can, if you have people who are working remotely because they've been infected and they're self-quarantining, make sure you have a weekly teleconferencing forum. Keep them in the loop. You know, I can tell you personally, being out of the loop now, going on almost 5 months of not being on site, yes, I see people virtually and I have conversations, but it's different than being with you, being in the same room with you, you know. So be thinking about just keeping people together, keeping them connected, and letting everybody know that, you know, hopefully we'll get back to normal and we can resume doing things the way that we did at one time. Looking also at ways to do things, like we said, that are, you know, delightful, that distract people, that, you know, bring some joy into the day, you know. So you could do something like, you know, daily contests of some kind, do stupid contests. I used to do something called the question of the day, and then whoever got the most answers to that question by the end of the day would get some sort of a silly prize. But it distracted people. It engaged them, you know. So the question of the day might be, how many residents had a red car, you know? And so it caused people to talk to each other, to talk about something other than the stressful things that were going on. As I said, send up something different for people to enjoy together. Fruit smoothies, you know, ice cream for everybody, something, you know, to delight them. And they say, oh my goodness, what is this for? You know, no, nothing. Just, you know, just to delight you, just to give you a distraction today. And then doing something, you know, for the staff. And I know a lot of you are, but I don't think we can drop that ball. And that's what happens in something like this, is that in the beginning, everybody rushes to do all of these things, but things begin to fade, that enthusiasm, and we become, you know, it becomes tedious. So don't let it become tedious. Remember, again, keep that subcommittee in place. You know, you need to have a group of people who are focused on morale. Certainly now more than ever, you know, people are leaving our industry because it's not a satisfying situation. And now with people saying to me that it's not even fun to go to work, they don't look forward to it, we might lose more unless we change that culture internally and stay focused on it. So maybe now is the time to do something that I've encouraged in many of the conversations I've had with you live at your conferences over the years, where you need a behavioral health or a quality of life committee. Maybe residents and staff together talk about the things that we could do to feed morale, to promote, you know, proactive thinking and social, you know, interaction. So, you know, we've really got to support each other through this. And I think there are lots of ways to do that if you just look beyond a little bit and consider everyone's suggestions. You know, there's no stupid idea. So, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but how much better will you be if you just try? So for those people who are, you know, working on the front lines, certainly for ourselves, you know, it's really important to take care of yourself, to make sure that you are always at your best for the people who rely on you. Certainly you're not going to be the person that they need or can rely on if you're not taking care of yourself. And I think that that's a very important, you know, point of all of this, is to make sure that we're doing the things that are going to make us the best caregivers that we can be. So important that you, you know, take time out to do things, that you encourage your staff to do the same thing, to not work, you know, hours on end, to not accept people working double shifts several days in a row, because all that's going to do is deplete them emotionally, physically, you know, certainly their stamina, their ability to carry out and to be accurate and, you know, to be correct in the work that they're doing is all going to be, you know, impacted if they're not sleeping, if they're not taking that rest. So, you know, watch the staffing. Make sure that, you know, people are taking time out to do the things that they need to do for themselves. Certainly, you can be very observant of other people. If I become, you know, start looking a little disheveled when I come to work, you know, maybe you can ask me if I am, you know, doing anything to nurture myself. And if not, maybe you can give me some good suggestions. But certainly taking time out to do things that bring you joy. A lot of people like to read. It, you know, takes them off to another place. And maybe combining some of those things that you enjoy and doing it with your resident. You know, everybody has a favorite. So maybe you like to read, maybe you could read out loud or enjoy an audiobook together with someone. You know, anything we can do to sort of fill that human void is important, both on and off the job. So, you know, be thinking about what happens at work and things that should be happening outside of the work environment to take care of yourself. Look at how you take care of your body. This is not the time to, you know, start cutting meals back or not sleeping or, you know, I know gyms are closed, but there's a lot of ways to, you know, make up for that. I live in a 6-story apartment building, so I take the elevator to the 6th floor and I walk all the way down each floor, back and forth, down the stairs, all the way down to the 1st floor, and then I go back up to 6 and I start again. I'm climbing the stairs up. I'm old and my hip doesn't like that, but I can make it down. And, you know, it still gives me a lot of those steps that I need each day, even though I don't have a treadmill or the elliptical, you know, to help me out. So get a lot of exercise. Make sure that you pay attention to your own internal barometer of how you're feeling. You know, make sure that you eat good food. Certainly now, you know, is a good time to learn how to cook. Certainly it's not, as fun as going out to dinner or letting somebody else, you know, cook for you. But certainly there is an advantage to making healthy food and knowing what goes into it. And certainly avoiding, like we said earlier, too much indulgence in alcohol. A glass of wine is okay, but not the whole bottle. And, you know, making sure that we stay away from those drugs, whether recreational or otherwise, that tend to, you know, sabotage our stamina, our well-being, sometimes even our focus, you know. Don't hesitate if you are feeling a depression, if you are feeling an intensified anxiety, talk with your physician. You know, make sure you don't overlook your own overwhelming emotions because those things can escalate. But doing the things that you can to stay healthy and encouraging your staff, maybe even starting a campaign for wellness in your building throughout all of this may be another thing that could help you. And lastly, I think it's important to stay in touch. You know, make sure that you're reaching out to other people. I know I have a predominance of elder friends in their 80s and their 90s, many of whom have all of their faculties and are just compromised physically and living at home. So I've been reaching out, making sure, you know, that if somebody needs some company, whether we do it virtually or I spend a little bit of time at a safe distance, you know, my one friend sits on the front stoop and I, you know, stay in my car and we talk across the front lawn kind of thing. But reach out to those people and think about encouraging your residents as well to make connections through media with others in the community, perhaps in the same facility or in the immediate community that, you know, don't have anyone to talk to. Maybe these are ways to, you know, help us to feel better about the whole circumstance. Sometimes when we focus on people who don't have as much as we have or have a more dire circumstance, you know, it feeds our own feelings of well-being, and helping behavior can be extremely therapeutic. So that brings us to the end of our conversation today. And like I said, this is the beginning of a 3-part series. We'll be talking again next week at the same time about modifying therapeutic activity and social service and psychosocial kinds of interventions that you might want to, you know, enhance as you go forward. This is my contact information. If there is anything that you'd, you know, like to have that I've put together for people on this topic, some of the resources, I'm happy to share those with you. And at my website, there is a blog there where I have a number of articles on psychosocial issues and a couple of new things dealing with mood and behavior and just COVID in general. So I'm going to turn this back over now to Dave, and I thank you all for being a part of today's conversation. I hope it was helpful to you, and we'll see if we have any questions now.
Thank you, Barbara, for presenting today. We are going to be sending out a link to the recording of this probably on Friday, so you'll be able to share it with other people on your staff. So watch for that link to come to you on Friday. And doesn't look like we have any questions, Barbara, so we'll go ahead and end today's webinar, and we'll talk to you next week, same time. Take care,
okay, everybody. Okay, thank you again, Dave. Take care. Bye.